This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Payne here, live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. We hear horror stories about artificial intelligence overthrowing the human race, Terminator style. But AI can't be all bad, right? Professor at New York Institute of Technology, Kevin LeGrandeur, is going to explain how humans and AI might be able to coexist and what our future may look like. Thanks for joining me, Kevin.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, everybody's always writing an article, or you're reading an article or watching a movie about how AI is going to destroy the world. But this has kind of happened before. Could you walk me through that?
You mean AI has destroyed the world before? Or
I should have phrased it better.
But I'm willing to consider that.
We're all living in the Matrix. No, I meant like technology has always been advancing and there's always been bumps in the road. So it's not the first time that's happened, or is it?
Well, it's the first time it's really happened with artificial intelligence. I mean, previous bumps in the road have been more along the lines of robots taking jobs as far back as the 1950s. But this time's different because this time we're talking about artificial intelligence, which is computers that can to some extent learn on their own and teach themselves things. So they're much smarter than robots used to be. So, yeah, the big threat right now is that AI could take a lot of jobs away from people. It's already doing.
When I think of like technology taking jobs away, my father, he works at a steel company. It used to take about 6 or 7 guys to be able to do one order. Now it's just one guy and he uses this big machine. So, you know, that was a hard labor kind of job. When it comes to AI, they're going to take, is it going to take like the managerial position? Should I even bother going to college now, or any kind of kid go out there and do college?
Right. Well, it's not quite that dire. As a matter of fact, the kinds of jobs you're talking about, managerial jobs, are the jobs that are probably going to be the best jobs for humans to have in the future. Mark Cuban was just talking about this the other day, it's an article in the New York Times, I think, where he was talking about the fact that 10 years from now, having a degree in philosophy or history or English is going to be better paying than having a job in having a degree in computer science. So, I mean, I think the AI is rapidly changing the job environment. What AI is able to do is to take over jobs that are dirty, dangerous, and boring, and do those jobs much better than humans. So like your dad's job in the steel industry, a lot of those jobs now can be automated because they're repetitious tasks. So computers and AI are very good at repetitious tasks, and they're very good at physical tasks like lifting things or moving things. But they're not really good and probably never will be, at least in the foreseeable future, at things that are creative or design-oriented or dealing with relationships. So managerial jobs are really good jobs and probably will be even better in the future. So going to college actually is going to be the only thing that's going to save people from becoming unemployed.
I'm glad you said that, because using my father as an example again, he's dyslexic. And he actually never graduated from 8th grade. So, you know, he has no high school degree, and it's very difficult for him to read things for long periods of time. A person like him wouldn't be able to go back into college, continue education, so that he could get a better job. What about people like him who have low education?
That's a sticking point. These are the people that are going to be the first to lose their jobs. As your dad would probably tell you, probably a lot of his friends already lost their jobs in his industry. And the only way to save those people is to have focus on retraining. In other words, not going back to college, but having opportunities for retraining in the job that they're in. So that's partly the responsibility of the corporations that hire people. They need to make more opportunities available for people like your dad to retrain for other jobs. People involved in the industry, the employees, have to be willing to be retrained. And it doesn't always have to do with reading a lot of stuff. A lot of retraining is just learning how to use different tools. Most futurists predict that down the line, AI will take not whole jobs, but tasks from jobs will be taken from people. People will have to focus on different tasks within the same type of job. For instance, my accountant you know, most of what he does to do my taxes is crunching numbers, but actually TurboTax and other software already does that really well. So he's had to shift sideways as an accountant to focus more on personal relationship with me, on tutoring me about tax law and about things I can and can't do, sort of hand-holding. And so his job has sort of moved from being a numbers guy to more of a relationship guy. That's one example of a middle-class job that'll change. In your dad's case, a good example of how things are changing is Ford Motor Company this past fall announced that they were using prototypes of an exosuit, sort of an exosuit is a sort of exoskeleton worn on the outside of the body that's robotic and increases your ability to do physical things. So it enhances your physical abilities. So they made four of these exosuits, had Ford employees at two different factories using them. They're worn on they're like a vest. They're worn on the upper half of your body, and they support your arms as you raise them up in the air. Because, you know, on the assembly line, one of the jobs is to raise your hands over your head all day and screw in bolts to the bottom of a chassis. So the guys that do that and the women who do it, they get really bad fatigue and repetitive stress injuries. So these exosuits, they tried them, and it allowed these people to enhance their doing their job. They could do it faster and better and less wear and tear on the body. So that's a sort of integration of artificial intelligence and robotics with the human frame. That's the kind of thing that I think is going to happen more in the future. And it doesn't take much reading. You know, you just got to learn how to use a suit.
That's true. I know I wouldn't want to read the manual. I would just jump into it because that sounds like fun.
Yeah, there's another really good one like that called a sort of a bionic glove auto workers were trying. You put the glove on and it increases your muscle strength of your grip by about 10 pounds. So if you're handling tools all day, say maybe a drill driver all day, and you keep having to squeeze something, the bionic glove lessens the effort that you have to make to do that. So it enhances humans' ability to do repetitive jobs. Although I think mostly repetitive jobs are going to go away for humans. And what humans will end up doing is taking care of the machines more than using them. But there will also be a lot of integration of humans and machines.
It's funny you say that. My father, he works with this, he calls it a shot blast. I'm not sure if that's the official name for it, but it shoots little pellets onto a metal plate and it cleans it. And he's like, yeah, they pay this guy six figures to come and fix it. And this guy doesn't know what he's doing.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, why not just retrain a factory worker, one of your own workers, to take care of that kind of thing? A friend of mine the other day was telling me that she had the same kind of situation in a lab she was working in. This machine she had to use kept breaking. And every time it broke, they had to fly somebody in from Germany at very high expense to fix the machine. So the third time he showed up, she watched what he did. And then when the machine broke the next time, she went to her boss and said, I can fix that machine. If you pay me a little bit extra, I can take care of that machine and do my job. And that solved the problem.
That is smart. That was smart. I hope she got a couple thousand more a year. That was very smart on her part. But that's talking about robots. Now, going back to AI, there have been a couple of AIs. I think Google put one out, and I forgot who else put one out. I think it was some company in China. They were flawed. Because they ended up being, you know, the users were kind of teaching them racist things because they were trolling the big companies and they were teaching them to do all this bad stuff. And before you know it, this AI, they had to just shut it down. So AI isn't perfect. Why would we replace people with something that's imperfect?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that's kind of a big issue that I'm glad we're touching on, which is the overestimation and overhyping of AI. AI has a lot of potential, but probably in the long term. In the short term, it's not going to be a magic bullet for a lot of things like people think it will. You're not going to, you know, be able to have Rosie the robot cooking your dinners for you and cleaning your house, that kind of thing. AI is still pretty dumb, and I think that the example you're talking about is a chatbot called I can't remember the name of it, but those programs are called chatbot programs, and there are all kinds of them on the web. There's one, the oldest one is called Eliza, was invented in the 60s, and it's still up there. If you do a Google search for Eliza chatbot, you'll come up to it, and you can converse with it. The problem is, like you said, the newest chatbots, they try to make them intelligent by giving them learning algorithms. So they teach themselves and learn from the conversations. Well, get a couple of 16-year-old boys on the line with a female chatbot, and you're going to have some crazy things happen, like the kinds of things you're talking about. They use bad words and just for fun to see what happens, and then the chatbot learns nothing but bad words. So AI is still not really, really advanced yet. Another example of how it's not so advanced is think about using Siri. You can use Siri to you can say, "Hey Siri, find me a good Mexican restaurant nearby," and it can do that in a couple seconds, comes up with a list. But if you say, "Hey Siri, find a good Mexican restaurant nearby, pick the best one, and make me a reservation for 4 people at 7 o'clock tonight," it can't do all that stuff because it's not sophisticated enough yet. So these virtual digital assistants that everybody's starting to trumpet, they don't really do a huge amount compared to what, you know, the ideal is.
When it comes to AI, I always think of Terminator. Like, that's what I'm like, it's going to take over the world like that, or the Matrix. Like, it's going to be so smart that we'll be at its mercy. Why do you think people think of those kind of outcomes rather than it being almost like it should be a utopia? Everybody laying back, we're just talking philosophy, somebody else doing our work.
Yeah, well, those are much more sensational things, right? Terminator idea and the Matrix. Those are very sensational ideas, and so they catch people's attention more. You know, as far as something like the Terminator scenario, which is what scientists actually call it, the Terminator scenario of having an AI that's so smart, it's way smarter than humans and considers humans pests and wants to get rid of them. I mean, I think one of the best illustrations I know of why that wouldn't happen is Dilbert had a cartoon once about that, where Dilbert's talking to his boss and his boss is saying, "I want to be more famous than Larry Page. I want to be more famous than Elon Musk. They're just making spaceships. I want to make a spaceship with an AI that goes out to other planets and explores the planet. How soon can you do that?" And Dilbert says, "It depends. How long an extension cord do I have?" There you have a problem right there. What's going to power something like a Terminator and keep it running? If you ever have a threatening machine, just pull the plug, hit the off switch. The other objection I have to the whole Terminator scenario is that it overestimates our programming capabilities. Think about the last time you tried to do something to your computer and it crashed. So I would say Terminator will work just fine until its software hit a glitch and then it powered down and somebody had to call up the help desk.
That's all very funny because that's so true. I like it's the overestimization of our own abilities, which is kind of funny. We think so well of ourselves that we're doing so awesome that you're right. My laptop always crashes whenever I open up Sony Vegas.
Too many windows.
But then what about nanotechnology, things like that, or like replacing your arm with a robot arm? I mean, is that more believable?
Yeah, that's already on the drawing board and being worked on. That's called BMI, or brain-machine interface, and people are working on that at all kinds of universities. I've talked to some of them, and at Michigan, University of Michigan, for instance, a team there is working on brain-machine interface precisely to help people have better prosthetic arms. So the idea is you make a digital arm and put in elements of artificial intelligence into the arm, so very sophisticated computing, and then you hook it up to the nerves in the arm, and the next thing you have to do, they've done all that, but is to find a way to interface that arm with the brain. And so they're working on that now, finding ways to translate the brain's neural impulses to something that the arm can read, vice versa, the movements of the arm and impulses it sends as readable by the brain. So there's been some real advances on that. Two of them that off the top of my head I could talk about is a group led by Theodore Berger at the University of Southern California has made prosthetic memory. The way it works is the memory resides in the hippocampus, a sort of small half moon or quarter moon shaped organ in the brain. The cells in there start dying, you lose your memory. And that's what happens to Alzheimer's. It, a lot of times the hippocampus dies off, the cells in there can't store memory anymore. So what he's experimented with is replacing pieces of the hippocampus with chip. And he's found a way to record the nerve impulses from the hippocampus that create memories onto a chip. And then he's taken rats, excised the chunk of the hippocampus that was recorded, replaced it with a chip, and it works perfectly. So what he's been able to do is a mouse will learn to run a maze, and then he'll cut out that part of the hippocampus that the memory is stored in. The rat can't run the maze anymore. And then he replaces it with a chip that the memories are stored on. It runs perfectly. Not only that, but he can take that chip and put it into a different mouse or rat, and that rodent can run the maze, never having run it before. So for Alzheimer's patients, that's the promise there, is that you can store memories before they're lost and then reimplant them digitally as the person loses memories. Of course, the negative side is that you could also get implanted with false memories that you never had, like the rats that ran the maze that had never run it before. The key innovation there is that his team found a way to translate nerve impulses to digital impulses by using a special language they developed.
Would the mouse even be the mouse anymore? you took all the mousiness out of his brain. Is he even the same mouse? That is a hell of a question.
Yeah, I mean, the memories are all the same memories, so I would say it's probably the same mouse. But if you take a mouse and implant memories from another mouse, then you have a big question there. Much bigger if they use it on human beings.
Exactly.
What if I were able to be implanted with some of your memories? Would I then be part you, or would I be me with some knowledge from you or memories from you? And, yeah, that's a big ethical quandary.
We would be Mevin, Mason and Kevin.
Right.
we would just be like a brand new like person then, right? I mean, is that even ethical?
Well, I don't know. That's a big question. Right now we're using it on mice. I think he's done some work on apes. The ethical questions are kind of muted, but once that stuff gets implanted in human beings, then you have a lot of questions coming up. And he's not the only one working on this. Elon Musk has famously just started last year a whole company based around this kind of thing called Neuralink, and he's sunk, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into this company. And it's working on just one product right now that I know of, and that's called, he calls it Neuralace. And it's sort of like an implanted Wi-Fi antenna that you can implant in your brain, and it'll allow brain-machine interface, BMI, wirelessly. So you don't have to have wire coming out of your head. And they already, you know, they implant things in people's heads already. People who are epileptic and have Parkinson's, that's really severe, they do a brain implant that's sort of a pacemaker for the brain. So it cuts down on epileptic seizures, for instance. But those people that have those, they have wires, you know, coming out of their head, and it's very clunky. But if you had a Wi-Fi antenna embedded in your brain, then perhaps you could make far more easy solution to that kind of a brain pacemaker. But also, what Musk likes about it is the sort of more distant possibilities of communicating directly with machines with your brain. Now, there's another question about who will you be if you can listen to all the machines around you in real time with your brain?
Are you even human?
Yeah. And how much are you influenced by the machines? Imagine communicating at lightning speed with, say, a factory full of robots. I mean, theoretically, that could happen. Your dad could be the only person in the whole steel factory and be running things through wireless communication with the machines around him via his implant.
Now, in a future like that, where you would be able to control a bunch of things, wouldn't that still put people out of jobs? I mean, it sounds like it's still coming down to one person, whether it's AI, it's a real person or a machine, they're going to be replacing a huge amount of people, or no, that wouldn't.
Well, that's precisely what there's a lot of argument about these days. One of my degrees is in economics, and a recent book I put out with a writing partner, James Hughes, called Surviving the Machine Age, is exactly about this question. And I guess the argument comes, the two sides are like this. One side is optimistic. They say that we're in another industrial revolution, this one having to do with AI. It's like the industrial revolution that happened at the early part of the 1900s. What happened then was, at first, a lot of people were put out of jobs. But after about 10 to 20 years, the next generation learned how to use more fully all of the new devices in that industrial revolution, and it actually created more jobs than it destroyed. It's a process that an economist named Schumpeter calls creative destruction. So it destroyed jobs only to create like 10 more in each one's place. So the optimists think that's going to happen here too. The problem I see with that argument is that you got 10 years to 20 years where everything goes to pot. The pessimists agree with what you just said. Well, more and more people will be put out of jobs because more things will be automated and you'll need fewer people to run things. I tend to side with the first group that I think things will get better. There'll be brand new jobs we can't even imagine, and a lot of it will be driven by the new technology. And I think my own guess is that we'll have new types of implants and digital implants that will allow us to interface and work with machines in a more efficient way. We may even become more machinic ourselves in that sense. Like now people have pacemakers and insulin pumps embedded in their body. We might have all those things plus you know, things embedded in our brain to help us communicate with machines and do our jobs better. And then might spawn whole new jobs. I think that'll probably happen, but I think in the near term, we're going to experience a lot of social disruption, which we're already seeing. A lot of people being put out of jobs, social unrest, anger, and resentment. And that's already happening.
When you compare it to the Industrial Revolution type of stuff, that was a smaller population. And now we're kind of more global, too. So you know, there's way more people in the world than there was then. We're all competing for the same kind of jobs. I don't know. I mean, I want to be optimistic because I'd love to be, you know, in a robot, my own robot suit. But I can't help but to think of somebody like my father who he may not have fun in the robot suit.
Well, your dad being dyslexic has a hard time reading, but technology is already spawning new ways of obtaining information, you know, via audio and video. That didn't exist even 20 years ago. So I think in the future, that kind of trend will continue, that people will be upgraded not only by technology, but we've all been upgraded through education over the past 100 years. If you think back 100 years, only maybe half our population was literate. And so they couldn't learn to do new jobs by reading anything. Now we have something like 95% literacy, at least here in the United States. So in a sense, we're all smarter. All of us would score higher on an IQ test than the equivalent person, say, 100 years ago. Your dad would probably be able to score a lot higher in any kind of intelligence test than somebody who worked in a steel factory 100 years ago because he just knows a lot more. I studied algebra in, I think, my second year of high school. Now kids are studying algebra in junior high. So people are learning harder things at earlier ages because education is speeding up and people are sort of epigenetically getting smarter. So I think that people will upgrade, but I also think that you're right in the sense of population growth. I think the biggest hidden problem that we don't talk about anymore, I don't know why, is population explosion. We have 7.5 billion people now, and we used to talk about that all the time in the 70s and 80s as a problem. Now nobody seems to talk about it.
Why is that? Because that is a big problem. I mean, you're not just, you know, in my case, I'm not just competing for jobs here in Chicago. I have people from all over the U.S. trying to get the same job I'm getting because they're willing to relocate. Or you can have people from other countries wanting to get the same job I am. Why aren't people talking about the population anymore?
You know, I don't know. I think the best, only reason I can think of is that people have gotten less concerned with it because they're not starving anymore. There's something called the Green Revolution that happened in the 1980s, where scientists discovered or developed all kinds of new crops that could live on less water, could be packed more to the acre, were more resistant to bugs. And so you could grow a lot more, say, corn on 1 acre than you could in the 60s. And suddenly people were able to eat again. So the Green Revolution, you know, happened, really helped out people in India and China and even Africa. So we have people, I think, doing better these days on a basic level in terms of ability to survive. And so I think that sort of just tamped down the urgency of overpopulation. Even if people aren't starving more, they're still only have so many resources on the planet. You know, and I think that's going to be the sneaky way that nature could get us. I mean, we have lots of technology, and we keep, you know, Ray Kurzweil thinks we'll become immortal by the year 2050 because of technology. But you know, then who's going to pay for all that? Where's all the energy going to come from? And how's the Earth going to support a bunch of immortal people who are still having babies?
That's why we need to go to Mars.
Yeah, that would help, wouldn't it? Now, if we can just get that off the ground. I ask my students all the time, I ask these sort of thought experiments. One of them is, if you could pick up and go to Mars tomorrow, and it were possible to colonize the planet, would you do it? It would be a one-way ticket, really. Most of them say no.
Really?
So, yeah, I mean, would you do it?
Yeah, in a heartbeat. They wouldn't want me, though.
Mars. Most of my students worry because Mars is such a harsh environment, and space travel is dangerous, and they don't want to die on another planet, and they, you know, all kinds of reasons like that. So I'm not so sure how easy it would be to get people to ship off to another planet. But the pilgrims did it back in the 17th century, so...
Well, I think I would go. I would go. If given the opportunity, I would jump on it. I would love to help the human race. Why not? It's one for many, right? I don't see a problem with it.
Do to go back to nanotech, another question I ask my students is, if you could swallow a pill tomorrow full of little, you know, tiny robots the size, just a couple nanometers across, the size of molecules, that would repair all damage to your body at the cellular level constantly and make you essentially immortal, would you do it?
No, I don't think I could do that one. But that sounds cool, unless I can turn them off and just be like, okay, I'm ready to pass, like I'm done.
Interesting. I would say half my students, who are all, you know, in their early 20s, say they don't want to do it. The other half say, yeah, I mean, sounds like an adventure. Some of them, my wife's first response was, well, so how long would I live? And I said, well, let's say 300 years. And she paused and she said, does that mean I have to work for 180 years to finance my retirement? So that was her first objection, having to work for 180 years.
She's right. That's why I said I want the off button, because it's not going to be, how are you going to survive for infinity? I mean, you can't just lay around everywhere. This isn't going to be like the Vampire Chronicles where it's drama all the time. This is going to be boring most of the time.
Well, if you believe some futurists, not only will we be immortal, but we'll have robots and AI doing most of our production for us of food and housing and things like that. So we'll be able to spend more time doing leisure activities.
See, and that's when the Terminator thing is going to happen, because they're going to sit there and say, why am I doing all the work while you're sitting there eating and getting fat?
Right. Yes. So you can see, I bring up these questions and you have two sides of every issue, no matter how happy it sounds. My students don't seem to think utopia sounds very interesting.
Did you hear about, what is that, Utopia 52? Oh, it's such a long time with the rats, where they were given everything, and eventually they were just like the clean ones and the mean ones or something. I forgot how it went. But yeah, it didn't work out. Utopias usually don't work out.
Yeah, some rat always wants more pellets of food than the other rat, and then you have a fight, then things go downhill.
Well, technology is something I think that will be with us forever. When it comes to the evolution of technology, do you think we're going to go in the direction of just replacing our bodies? Or is it going to be AI that is going to replace us and we get to sit and do nothing?
I think it could be either one of those things. I think our bodies will be modified with AI. And down the road, I mean, like 200 years down the road, if we don't blow ourselves up first, I think we're going to look a lot different as a species. A lot of people talk about that. Transhumanists talk about the modifying of the species, but after modification down the road, the new species that is often termed post-human, a lot of people, including me, think that we'll probably end up modifying ourselves with technology and biomedicine so that we end up looking substantially different.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you being here. For those that are interested about you and the subject, where can they find more at?
You can go to nyit.edu, which is this where my school is, or just Google me. That's the easiest way. Kevin LeGrander, Google my name. It's L-A, not L-E. There's all kinds of information on what I do.
You also have a book coming out. What's the name of it?
Yeah, it just came out. It's called Surviving the Machine Age, and it's a book I put together with James Hughes, who's a sociologist up at University of Massachusetts.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapayne.com. That's masonverapayne.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.